Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Sarah Goa. Sarah is a general partner at Greylock Partners, a leading Silicon Valley venture capital firm with over $3.5 billion in assets. As a general partner, Sarah mainly invests in early stage companies with an emphasis on B2B applications, infrastructure, fintech, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, augmented reality, and healthcare. Prior to Greylock, Sarah worked at Goldman Sachs, where she invested in growth stage technology startups. In this interview, she provides perspectives on robotic process automation, machine learning, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, fintech, and more. We also discuss what Sarah looks for when making investments, the benefits of having parents who are entrepreneurs, why she believes that a company's size and scale can prohibit its ability to remain current, and a variety of other topics. Sarah Goa, welcome to Technovation. Great to speak with you today.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
Excellent. So I thought we'd begin, Sarah, with, first of all, of course, you are a general partner at Greylock. And I thought maybe I'd give you a chance to talk a bit about the areas you invest in and how you choose those. I know it's a variety of swim lanes that you occupy. And so I'm curious what you see as some of the themes across those, as well as some of the aspects of those that really particularly excite you.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a relatively small team at Greylock, and so there are definitely areas where people have stronger theses, but also some just like macro beliefs we as a team together hold to be true, right? And I kind of organize that into like from the apps layer down, like there is an explosion of software that is happening today. And so I'm one of those people that believes we're actually relatively early in, you know, the current generation of software innovation. It's not just we're going to move, you know, these 1, 2, 3 core ERP or CRM systems to the cloud. The ability to like buy and use software in more democratized ways, to connect data in different software systems. I think we're just going to see more categories that really matter in SaaS than there were in the sort of traditional enterprise software world. I think that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. And so one area that I've been personally really interested in that wave of innovation is financial software, just because that's something that has been traditionally like a very conservative area, and we're still really early in the transition. And I think there's a lot you can do around something that's very important to every enterprise to make them more agile, to take advantage of fintech innovation. And it's something that's just naturally like networked and could be better handled in like software workflow.
Mm. And what are there examples of companies you're involved with now in that space?
I think things we're involved with in stealth and things we're looking at. So mm-hmm. you'll have to ask me. Yeah. In 60 days.
I'll stay tuned.
But I think if you first you have that sort of core software innovation, and I think there's going to be category creation beyond what is traditionally thought of as ERP or even productivity. Those are sort of two of the very large categories that people commonly think of from, you know, the software 1.0 world. But then if you believe this explosion of innovation is happening, then there are lots of secondary effects too, right? So you have a problem of if we're in this persistent best of breed world, how do you integrate everything? How do you use and manage all of those APIs? How do you secure a world where your end users are in 200, 500 different apps all the time? How do you manage identity for all those things? And so some of these things have already begun to play out. So we're very lucky to be investors in Okta, now a public company. But I think if you look at the integration and the security landscape, I think that story is not yet done, mm-hmm. right? So, or even robotic process automation is a area that is white hot right now. But if you think about what RPA is, it tends to be like connecting software workflows across many different systems. And in the sort of old on-prem world that used to be your custom processes for example, accounts payable in your configuration of SAP. That's like what people used RPA for. But I actually don't think that problem, you know, RPA exactly may not be the right solution, but some sort of automation that goes across different pieces of software and automates the pieces that are boring to do, I think that, like, we're also just early in that automation, mm-hmm. right? And so if I think about sort of those enabling pieces, I think we're also really early in that because the adoption of the apps has to happen too. And then I think sort of separate from everything that's happening on the app side, every company, every large company is trying to go through digital transformation, which I really think of as building software-oriented experiences that are better for their end customer. And in order to do that more effectively, there's this massive replatforming of the enterprise that's happening. So trying to get to a more agile set of infrastructure, cloud, microservices, totally new languages and frameworks and practices around software delivery. And so that's an area that I think we're really interested in investing into.
Hmm. Some of the areas you talked about, though certainly not all of them, some are distinct. We'll get into security, for instance. The security companies you invest in sell to companies that are typically not in the security space, so they are complements to each other. Mm-hmm. Fintech by contrast, for instance, there's sort of a co-optition oftentimes among fintech companies and traditional players like the Goldman Sachs of the world where you once worked. And it's an interesting sort of play from that perspective. To some extent, you've got to develop that ecosystem among the current players and sell to them and so on, while also developing sort of an interesting relationship with them in as much as you might come to, I'm speaking generally here without a specific company in mind, come to compete with them in some of those other areas as well. And I wonder how you think a little bit about the value proposition these companies have and their opportunities when they've got that co-opetition in mind.
It's a really good question. I'd say, like, we, you know, we have like an executive briefing program, and a lot of technical leaders, they'll come and talk to us, one, because they actually want to figure out how to, like, bring partnership and innovation into their companies. But two, because they actually want to talk about, like, what's happening out there in terms of competition to them, right? So I had somebody say to me the other day, like, oh, we don't want to be Netflixed or Ubered in terms of, like, their industry, right? I'd say Greylock will invest in both, like, the enabling technologies for enterprises and things that are more like vertical direct attacks. But I don't think that those companies get confused as to who they are, really, actually. One of the reasons is I think that the companies that really succeed on the enterprise side, like, you have to be very customer centric in order to, you know, build a product that's good for the customer and the end user to begin with. And so the likelihood that you're going to want to cannibalize that business once you've built something that's useful for them and, like, go after their lunch instead of just figuring out other ways to serve that customer, it's just not something I've seen at Greylock. And when there are sort of so many other things that you could do to expand within that customer or other services you could offer them. I guess one example would be, like, we have fintech companies. So, like, Oportun is an at scale, like, consumer lending business, for example. But we also have companies that offer software to financial services firms, right? So Blend is a company that helps large financials create, like, a digital on-demand mortgage origination experience. And I just don't think that they're going to get mixed up into the different models, mm-hmm. right? Even though they may offer more value for that end user in different ways.
As I mentioned a moment ago, security is an area where you have particular depth. You are, if I've got it correctly, currently on the board of Screen and Obsidian Security, past board member of Demisto as well.
I definitely like security.
And an area that is certainly, one might say, unfortunately, continues to be growing in relevance and importance, and a lot of players that are growing in this space. It's interesting, speaking and working with a lot with the people who are the buyers of the companies you invest in and others. One of the challenges for the modern day CISO or CIO or other technologists, the board, who are ultimately making some decisions relative to this as well, is the threat landscape is so complex and ever evolving, and it requires a sort of, again, an ecosystem of partners that you engage, which can be very challenging from a management perspective? How do you keep it all together? When, you know, where does one solution begin and another one end? How do they work together if they do at all? How do you make sure that there aren't gaps in your offering, or rather in your solutions, that may be perilous for you? And I wonder how you think about kind of the different lanes associated with security. You probably don't invest in all of them, but I'm curious how you think about those different lanes and how you give them priority or weight in terms of the areas that you focused on.
Yeah, it's a good question. There were something like 1,000 vendors at RSA this past year, and it's just really hard for any security team to go consume that successfully. So I'd say of the many opportunities for new companies in security, we first just try to focus on sort of the subset of problems and market opportunities where we're like, this is going to be so much bigger in 5 years as a problem set that we, have to be a part of this company. It's not just going to be another point solution and another vendor people have to add to their stack. It's going to be much more important, or it's going to replace in budget or importance or workflow something people already have, right? And so several of the companies that we have announced investments in recently in security, like, they had that sort of secular shift where we're like, hey, if 5% of your security team used to care about application security for the apps you build internally, that could be 20% plus 5 years from now, right? And so investing in Screen, for example, which is a company that does application security management. So think of it, the security analog to APM, like companies like AppDynamics, which we were lucky to be a part of. The view is like, if companies are going through this digital transformation, application security as one lane is just going to become so much more important, and it's got to work in a modern way, right? And so Obsidian, just going back to, if you have this massive explosion of software, there are secondary effects. Obsidian is all about understanding activity and identity in all of your applications, right? So think Office 365 or Workday or Salesforce, like, where there is really sensitive data, it's not just your infrastructure that matters, right? It's like employee actions in all of these systems, or contractor actions, whoever has access. And so we think that's a secular growing problem. And I think another way to think of that is we believe that identity in all of these applications is going to become a new additional perimeter, because you don't own those applications, right? But you need some kind of control. So I think the first step for us is just to identify, like, what changes in the landscape are happening that are so dramatic, right? Enterprises building applications, or enterprises adopting a huge amount of SaaS that is actually quite important to their core business, that you need security to react to it, right? So I think you'll very rarely see us invest in a company just in response to, like, one individual innovation in attack type, for example, just because that doesn't necessarily feel like a big enough change to warrant a new vendor. But I think we think more about, like, innovation in the business landscape, other things the CIO might care about that security needs to react to, right? Innovations in, like, some sort of architecture. Like, the cloud is pretty different from, you know, building a data center and putting a wall around it. So I think that's the first piece. Some problems are just, like, too big in the industry for us to solve, so we won't take full responsibility for, you know, that fragmentation in security. But I think the other piece that we just encourage our companies to understand and is just to live in customer environments in a way that is going to make customers successful. Right. So, like, because we understand what you are saying, Peter, about, like, people already have all these tools, then your messaging, your positioning, your integration strategy, all of that should actually take into account the large company that you're talking to has a limited number of headcount in security and probably a couple hundred tools already. Right. And so if you, like, are really customer centric as a product founder and a CEO, you're like, okay, I get it. And, like, we're going to make this really easy for you to consume in the sea of other things you have, which is not a complete answer, but I think it's a good philosophical approach. And then the last is just, that explosion of innovation. I think the reality is that the innovation engine in security has for a long time been younger startups, right? It's an area of constant acquisition, and it's just an area where the pace of change is so fast that it's quite hard for the large vendors to keep up in general. And so I actually would say that it is, I bet on a per headcount basis, security teams deal with like more products than other teams in technology. And so I think it's actually going to be a competency for security teams to like be really good at dealing with a fragmented landscape and constant innovation. I think that's true in the overall technology organization, but it's especially acute in security. I'd say like the promise of Demisto and what they could do for their customer base and now Palo Alto's, it really was like, oh, we have to deal with the secondary effects of this like rapid explosion in innovation. Cause a big, important concept in Demisto was like, let's integrate all these products that you have and let's try to automate some of the workflow across them. So your security team doesn't need to learn every new product that you add.
Right? I see. Interesting.
So sometimes we directly address the problem that you're talking about too, as a customer problem.
Yeah. So, and I guess that means that, I mean, obviously there are some companies that have been particularly acquisitive in the space. There are some who are themselves security behemoths who continue to acquire other companies to fill in gaps in their overall portfolio. There are some companies that have security, like a Cisco, for example, that has a security arm that has itself been very acquisitive. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm hearing you say that the pace of change, the need to remain current, the need to pivot quickly as opportunities or threats, for that matter, that you are addressing that become opportunities to the security company. In some ways, it's more difficult for the behemoths that are growing these portfolio companies, which theoretically ought to be the easiest or easier for major enterprises to engage, you know, one-stop shop for all of your solutions and security.
Yeah.
Part of what you're saying is the problem with engaging with companies like that is as they get larger, their ability to have that entrepreneurial spirit to pivot appropriately, to seize new opportunities, to recognize changes in the landscape and so forth, that actually that size and scale actually works against their ability to do so, perhaps more so than other areas in technology. Am I hearing you right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, don't get me wrong, there are large security vendors that are like really competent organizations that I have a ton of respect for. But I'd also say security is like, is an area of technology where like 50% good enough, like doesn't do you very much good, right? So, you know, you block 50% of attacks, like, how do you tell the CEO on board that, right? And so I think a part of it is just the structural problem, which is like if, and I think everybody deserves like the best software at good value across the entire technology organization and corporation. But you can actually get by with, you know, 20% less usable software in some scenarios, if there's like really good benefits to centralization and integration of data in some software ecosystems. In security, I think the challenge is some of the large security and systems vendors with a bunch of products, they haven't integrated them very well. So you don't get the benefit of like, oh, this stuff works together magically, and it's actually easier to handle because it's a bunch of different products. And two, like if it only works 50% as well as we were talking about, it just doesn't, that's not good enough, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned RPA a moment ago. And somewhat part of the way I think about RPA is it's in some cases the sort of gateway to broader ML and AI ultimately. They are all sort of generally in a similar set of topics. I know AI is the biggest perhaps of those three topics as an area you're getting more involved in. You're part of the AI fund, Andrew Ng's AI fund. I'd be curious with your own perspectives on where we are in the state of artificial intelligence, its adoption, its sort of value creation. Obviously, we're quite a ways, most people hypothesize we're quite a ways from artificial general intelligence, but there's a lot happening in the world of AI that's already creating a tremendous amount of value for enterprises. And I wonder, you know, where your head is on the opportunities related to it currently.
Yeah, I actually think we're just at the beginning of discovering like what the different bottlenecks to enterprise adoption are, right? And I do think RPA is like an interesting entry point into broader automation within the enterprise. But I guess one belief that I have just from studying a little bit of like startup and business history in the technology field is that you you have eras of sort of core technological and infrastructure innovation, and then like products and consumption gets absorbed after that, right? And so we've had this amazing era of innovation in core machine learning, and I think the very large consumer internet companies who whose entire business could get boiled down to a single algorithm or two that like really moved the bottom line. So, you know, if I show you this photo instead of this other photo in your feed, you are more likely to continue looking at this social network, and I will have more ad inventory. If I, show this ad versus this other ad, the click-through rate is X versus X minus 0.001%. And that represents like tons of money to the bottom line of some of the consumer internet companies. And it was an area where these consumer companies just had a ton of data and a ton of relatively modern infrastructure, great engineers, and a ton of like financial incentive to go like get that algorithm to be as fast and adaptive and accurate as they could. And so I think that's one of the reasons that they adopted machine learning faster than others. It's really complicated to boil down most businesses to that one algorithm, and people's infrastructure isn't as unified as, you know, an internet company built just in the last 10 or 15 years in general. And so I think because this massive investment in machine learning and advancement from both the consumer internet companies and the academic community has happened over the last 5 or 6 years, now, like the rest of the business and technology ecosystem can go reap the benefits, right? So, you have TensorFlow and all these open source frameworks, research papers that are continually published about, better and better model architectures, new discoveries in machine learning. And because people have realized how valuable a field ML could be, and it's very inspirational. I mean, you know, there are secondary effects on the workforce as well, as we were just talking about, but just because it's an area of such high interest, and you also get a broader and broader set of people both in the engineering community who now understand how to work with machine learning, and coming out of education system, who actually, like, the number of people who have some sort of ML degree is a multiple higher than it was 3 years ago, even, right? And I think, like, these resources, the open source, the research, the amount of talent that understands ML, that is going to open doors for the rest of the business community to take advantage of it. And so now I think what we're seeing is, okay, so I think, like, what are the bottlenecks to enterprises actually getting value out of machine learning? We're discovering that there's sort of an end-to-end developer stack for machine learning applications that is missing. The data that people have for machine learning is not exactly in the form that that they need it to be in, right? Just core supervised machine learning, being able to take tagged input data and translate it into outputs is gonna be applicable across a huge amount of different fields, but people don't have that tagged. They don't have that labeled data, right? And so I think just zeroing in on where the bottlenecks are in people developing machine learning applications is sort of the next step. And I think a lot of that is like, so I see the sort of different areas where Greylock could be investing in sort of machine learning native horizontal applications that try to sort of just do more work for us based on the data in those applications. Vertical machine learning native applications, which is sort of the same thing, but they get deeper into a vertical workflow, use different data, understand different business problems, and then the infrastructure to make this all easier for people who need to build custom models, mm-hmm. right? And I just think we're still early in all of it.
Yeah. The extent to which your description both of RPA and ML, more generally speaking, you talk about understandably the development of algorithms in some cases to do what humans have traditionally done. So taking a process, for example, that is repetitive and automating it essentially, and then eliminating the need for that. The algorithms themselves are, of course, are developed by people, and there's been a lot written, of course, about the inherent biases and so on of each of those. And there are some who are hypothesizing that as we are developing essentially virtual workers, we also have a need for evaluations of those virtual workers, almost like we would do for our employees. How are they doing? Which ones are improving and making us better? Which ones are not? And firing some of those as a result of the quality of the decisions that are being made, or the quality of the data that's being presented to make decisions. And I'm curious if that's something you've put any thought into in terms of the extent to which this is replicating or taking the place of some of the things that people would typically do. Thinking about those is almost kind of part of your staff, if you will, and treating them accordingly.
Yeah, I think the RPA vendors like to use the robot as a human replacement analogy, mm-hmm. And I think it holds in some ways and it does in others, mm-hmm. right? You know, the way it holds is like you are offloading tasks from humans. And so, you know, if you have a really good RPA program, then you can reduce headcount and restaff to other higher value tasks. I think the bots that people have in RPA deployments today are really not very intelligent. They don't learn very well. So your evaluation of them, humans do learn very well, right? And so these bots that are the industry standard across any of the large vendors today, there's nothing to measure yet. I do think that as the products in this automation area progress, it's a really interesting concept. But I think what people are really realizing as they go through these RPA efforts is, hey, my accounts payable process that I think is 8 steps is really 134 steps across these 6 different financial systems. And like really 25% of it is exceptions to what I think the core process is. And the people that I have in accounts payable, they are very good at handling all of those exceptions. And so I can put in a bot to offload the repetitive work that they are doing. And maybe that handles 20, 30, 60% of cases, but they're just handling it in a really static way, right? And so I think the way I would probably measure an RPA effort is like, how much of the process can I get coverage of, right? How many exceptions are there? And how much maintenance is there, I think, is a really, of that bot, is a way to measure, like, is it learning or not? But my belief is that, like, these bots are not actually learning very much today. We're still, I think they're definitely valuable to the business. Because as you said, it's really a forcing function to get to more future automation. But I just don't think that they're very sophisticated today in their ability to adapt to application change or process change. So I hope 5 years from now, what you're talking about, these sort of like management and visibility into bot performance will be an interesting opportunity because we actually have bots that get better at things over time. Mm-hmm. Not yet.
I think one of the underlying themes across the discussion is the dynamism of technology, of how fast things are changing, and how best to seize the opportunities as they do. I'm curious how you remain informed in topics as dynamic as the ones that we're talking about. How do you get your own read on the changing landscape and, you know, test your hypotheses? Of course, that begins with your colleagues. It benefits, I'm sure, tremendously by having a tidal wave of entrepreneurs coming across the desk from you, sitting across the desk from you, rather, with some frequency and understanding their own sort of hypotheses and theses that they're discussing with you. But generally speaking, how do you remain informed?
So I'd say first I scope the problem, which is you can't know enough about everything, right? And so I think of myself as rather T-shaped, where like I want to have a relatively comprehensive framework of the macro of what's happening in technology, and especially what's happening in the enterprise landscape. And within that, then there are certain areas where I'm like really excited to dig deep with entrepreneurs. And I spend a lot of time with customers and practitioners. So I think the reality about the enterprise technology space is there actually isn't that much high quality content that you can just go consume. This is one of the reasons I love your podcast, right? Because these are learnings that you can't really just go and take. Like you really have to get them from practitioners or from entrepreneurs, from people who have lived in that environment, because they're not written and talked about that much. And so I, at any one time, probably have 3 or 4 thesis areas where, like, I think there's something missing in the market. I probably came to that original conclusion or the beginning of that conclusion by talking to a smart practitioner or entrepreneur about an area and getting to some adjacent idea or some problem that they're trying to solve. That's one of the reasons I actually really love working in enterprise technology, like, is basically problem solving, right? And so I think unlike the consumer side, where I think you're more of both an anthropologist and a sort of instinctual product person, on the enterprise side, you're really just trying to understand different organizations, like what's changing in the landscape, and the technology practitioner, and then saying like, what are your most important problems, right? If you're in sales, in marketing, in IT, in security. And so I'm pretty interest driven in saying right now, like I really care about next gen infrastructure and problems in DevOps. I really care about security and problems I think are secular. And I really care about sort of back office software, from automation and RPA to, financial ERP in the cloud, right? And if you are sort of, if you scope down the set of things that you're proactively interested from a thesis point of view, then you can go meet all the companies, you can talk to practitioners about it. And you can read, but as I said, I don't think there are really good sources for this stuff.
I'd love to talk to you a bit more about next-gen infrastructure. You've alluded to some of it already, but I'd love to go a little bit deeper into that. You mentioned at the outset some of what your hypotheses around some of the real tectonic shifts that are happening, and that there are plenty left, despite what some people might say about SaaS, for instance, and where we are in the general progression relative to it. Can you talk a bit about some of your hypotheses that you're currently working on, and how they translate into the companies that you're investing in?
Yeah. I'd say there's probably 2 different companies that I'll mention that we're investors in that ride on sort of the next generation infrastructure trends, which I really think of as just change in architecture. One is Docker. So everybody's now heard of containers, microservices, and the agility that gives you, and also sort of the multi-cloud capabilities that come out of being container-based. I think another interesting company that we're involved with is a company called Cato Networks, which you can think of as sort of AWS for networking. And the idea with that company is as you have more and more remote workers, as your environment gets more and more distributed, as you have more and more SaaS applications, piping all of your traffic and all of your users back to your data center for security controls, your infrastructure stack, is just kind of impossible, right? You got to do something smarter at the edge in a distributed way. And that just hasn't been handled for enterprises. So Cato, generically in the SD-WAN space, I think of them as solving that architectural change for enterprises. Other things we're just paying attention to in the next-gen infrastructure landscape, I think everybody's got more and more data, more and more data stores. So, streaming architectures are here to stay. And I think really interesting, both from a data processing, data movement, and data storage perspective. I do think the overall area, like this is not a new one, but the area of DevOps is not a solved one, right? I think everybody's trying to figure out how to deliver software faster, better in distributed systems with microservices. And the pipeline problems around software delivery, if you have 5,000 plus developers, all those developers, like they want to choose all of their own tooling. You've made some acquisitions. You're trying to figure out how to invest different development resources in different areas. You have different expectations around stability and code coverage and all these areas. Like that's a pretty big problem, right? And so I think, I do think that looking for one vendor to be like the DevOps vendor or the microservices vendor is kind of like, that's not a, you know, these trends are not a panacea. And so like the secondary effects are huge. And so we think about, you know, when people have made a commitment, when large companies have made a commitment to try to develop software faster, what are the individual problems that they face? And then like, are there opportunities for new vendors surrounding that?
Right? Very interesting. I wanted to ask you how you select or what attracts you to a given entrepreneur versus another, what you're looking for. And I'd be curious also, I know it's part of your backstory that your parents are entrepreneurs. In fact, your father took a company public last year, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And so I can only imagine that having a front row seat through at least a portion of your childhood, perhaps. I don't know how old the company was or how early they were bitten by entrepreneurial bugs, but this is something that's sort of in your blood as well, having seen it with people you're so close with. But I'd be curious in your perspective on that.
Yeah. So my parents are tech entrepreneurs, and it was one of my earliest work experiences working with them on Casa, which is a networking infrastructure company. And I'd say like the biggest lesson, there's probably two things. One is just an interest thing. So I was one of those kids that was lucky enough to be like, you know, with parents and friends that said, you're 9 years old, build a Linux box. Right. And just not everybody has that experience. And then working with a bunch of people, it really just inspired me in terms of the joy of building technology products and like, being able to having a belief that like small teams with a better product idea and great execution, a lot of persistence can actually win against like huge vendors, right? And bring something better to the world. So I think one is just like just the really long-term like belief and interest in that. Two is I think a sense of how important customer centricity is in entrepreneurs and what that means. And so some early customers were actually the first funders of Casa Systems, like before VCs really were, right? And so it's a like being bootstrapped and then being customer funded is a less popular way to go in Silicon Valley. But I think it just ingrained in me that you know, the things that enterprise companies do, they can be incredibly important to a customer. And like, those are your closest partners, right? And so I look for entrepreneurs who also act that way. And gave me some respect for the idea that like, I obviously believe in early stage venture capital and the Greylock product, quote unquote. And I love my job, but I do have a ton of like respect for and belief that there are many ways to build a great company. And I think last is just, it gave me just a huge amount of empathy for how hard the entrepreneurial journey is. Right. Because, you know, not every part of Casa was, straight line up into the right. Right. And so I think you have to live it to really believe that. I think that that's an ethos that Greylock definitely has, the sort of empathy for the entrepreneur. I guess it probably had some impact on what I look for in entrepreneurs. I said customer centricity is certainly one. But I think in general, we tend to back people that have, and I tend to personally be excited about backing people who have a combination of like some sort of unique product vision, people who are thoughtful and committed to learning, as a first principle versus like any sort of existing capability. And then people who can recruit others to the cause, right? Who are good at recruiting and storytelling and communication. And then I think last is just people with a bias to action, right? Like the inertia that holds any startup back. If you don't do anything, nothing's going to happen, right? And so just like the willingness to make things happen and run through walls and operate at a certain pace to get a... It takes a lot of thrust to get a spaceship off the ground. And so I look for people like that. But by background, the founders that I work with, and I think Greylock more broadly works with, it varies quite a bit, right? People who are three-time founders of successful enterprise software companies, or like total outsiders, or dropouts from Brown that are very, very young when they begin their companies, right? The whole range exists. And so I think we're looking more for capability and insight and also personal chemistry with people. Like you really want to sign up for a 5 or 10 year marriage with a company if you have a concentrated portfolio. And if you don't love the company, you're not likely to go to bat for those founders, right? In terms of helping them recruit executives, onboard their early customers and design partners, which are hugely important. And just like continue to believe in the company when things don't go perfectly up and to the right the entire time, right? And so I think all of those sort of features matter, especially when we have so little data at the early stages to make decisions in terms of like actual revenue or usage or any of that. And we're largely, or I'm personally a largely early stage investors, and that's been the core of the Greylock practice for a long time. But I think the personal chemistry and just the interest in what people are doing also really matters.
Mm-hmm. You became a general partner at Greylock last year, and it was noteworthy for, among other reasons, that you are a woman, which will be very apparent to people who are listening to this, in a field where there are not a lot of women who are general partners in venture capital firms. And I wonder if you could take a moment and just reflect on that accomplishment, but I guess more generally kind of the state of the union of women in technology, generally speaking, VC more specifically, if you have any perspectives on that.
Yeah, well, I hope promotion to or hiring of a woman as a general partner is not noteworthy in some small number of years, right? So I guess that's the first point. Mm-hmm. I think the venture industry is very network oriented. And then the pools that people tend to be recruiting from are the founders that they've worked with, the executives they've worked with, and people from other investment firms or related fields. And all of those fields are not very diverse today, right? So I think there's a pipeline issue, there's a sort of judgment issue, and then there's a support issue. I do think that a lot of progress has been made over the last few years. And so, you know, I think the industry just owes a huge debt to the work that Eileen Lee and the All Raise team have been doing, both to change the court of public opinion about technology and venture and what level of diversity is acceptable and productive. And then, you know, take on practical initiatives to sort of, you know, further that agenda. So I'm really excited to be a part of that and think the world of the organization. But I just think it's an issue that, you know, I'm taking personal responsibility for, Greylock thinks about seriously, and I think the rest of the industry is going to need to make active moves on. And the people who figure it out faster than others, I think are going to have a business advantage as well. Because the world of venture capital does not reflect very well the world of the users and buyers that they're trying to serve, right? So we think about leaders in the enterprise of different departments or of IT, or consumers more broadly, and consumer purchasing power, everything from fintech to, you know, internet attention. Like, as far as I can tell, that is far more female and far more color diverse than VC is today, right? And so how can we expect to make great decisions about technology that is going to change the world if we're not reflecting the world we're a part of, right? And so I definitely think it's something that I am optimistic about progress on for the next 5 years.
That's great. Well, Sarah Gua, thank you so much for taking time with me today. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Peter.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Ray Greer, the Chief Executive Officer of OmniTrax.